Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Well, I tell you what, the last time the weather guys were on, we were asking them about why November was so harsh. But today, we want to know why December was so mild. Great to have you along as we visit with Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison and also a professor in atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Great to have you back, Steve.
Great to be here.
And John Martin, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. John, always great to see you.
Great to see you, Larry.
Wonderful to have you with us today as we talk about the weather and climate. We're kind of going to review a little bit what happened in this past year, maybe take a look ahead a little bit, and certainly try to answer your questions as well. What stands out to you as the more significant weather story of 2014? Maybe what questions you have about the current weather? Have you witnessed any interesting phenomena lately? And we've already got something up on our Facebook page, some photos that are, to me, really amazing. We'll talk about those photos, and maybe you have a weather photo as well. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show for that. Post a question there, or phone right now at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. As we look back at 2014, guys, what stands out to you sort of overall? John, maybe start with you.
Well, my favorite thing about the last year was the fact that we had a really cold, persistently cold winter in North America. Mm-hmm. And yet by a measure that we've just introduced in the last couple of years research-wise, tracing the size of the lower tropospheric cold pool by just taking a threshold temperature and measuring how much area it encompasses over the Northern Hemisphere, we're able to do that with data that goes back to the winter of 1948-49. Despite our cold winter here last winter, the hemisphere, Northern Hemisphere winter, was the warmest one in that 66-year time series.
Wow.
By that measure. So it points out how easy it is to slip into, you know, the confusion between local weather and global climate change, which is, mm-hmm. of course, warming the planet slightly and systematically. And yet last winter was a great example of that conundrum. So that's my favorite thing from last year's weather.
Well, Steve, what about you?
You know, to me, it seems almost like a bland. The cold winter was definitely something that I suddenly remembered. January and February, really cold. Cold November as well. And yet, as John's pointing out, in general, we continue to see the global warm. Actually, the regions in the Great Lakes continue to warm, even though we have this large natural variability where some years it seems pretty cold. November was cold. December is warm.
It's weird.
It's weird. Yeah, December's been an odd one as well that'll probably go down. Not much snowfall.
Right, yeah.
But it sure seemed cloudy.
Yeah, we had 16 straight days of clouds, I think.
Right, yeah.
And something like 18 so far this month of greater than 60% overcast or something like that. Today an exception, yesterday kind of an exception. So it's been an incredibly weird December.
Yeah.
After a very weird November. The other thing about November was not locally, but in the eastern Great Lakes, the enormous amount of snow they had around the 20th of November, right before Thanksgiving in Buffalo, which is notorious for heavy snow from the lake, but more than they've ever received before in that
That was unbelievable.
It really was.
And well forecast, even though the great governor of New York tended to blame the weathermen and not forecasting that very well.
Right.
They actually did a really good job of forecasting.
Yep, they did.
They average, I was looking at, we have some stories here that Judith found for us, and they average in Buffalo 92.5 inches of snow each year. And they had more than...
almost in one day. And they're not really done because now the warm December has kept Lake Erie from freezing. So there's a chance that they get a late December, January push of these kind of things. In fact, maybe in the next few days as it gets kind of cold, they may have some more lake effect snow. Not several feet, most likely, but they are under the threat for it. In a normal winter, December is cold enough to freeze much of Lake Erie because it's fairly shallow. It takes two cold months, November and December, will freeze it. And then that lake effect season's over for them.
Right.
Not so this year.
And
actually, I was just thinking, too, with the really cold winters and the freezing of Lake Superior, you know, allowed people to go see the ice caves. to walk over and to see that. And there was ice on Lake Superior all the way until June 10th.
Wow, isn't that something?
That's just amazing.
That's awesome. That is amazing. Yeah. I didn't remember it. If you told me it before,
Yeah, we're working on this weather and climate change of the Great Lakes regions, and then that's how I remembered the June 10th. I just looked that up just about a week ago.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. And then one other thing is the lack of weather in California, which, of course, led to the historic drought. They've had minimal relief from that recently, but this is a really dramatic drought that they've had in Central and Southern California, the Valley especially.
Right. Yeah.
And without snow in the mountains, which is money in the bank water-wise, they're in real trouble in the coming growing season.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they get, like 8 inches or something in one day, which is not the way you want to get it.
No, because it runs off. Right. Yeah, that's the problem. It just disappears.
Unless they can capture it, it's gone.
Right. Yeah. It's good for the mountains. You can get a huge snowfall because that is, as I said, money in the bank. It lasts all winter long, but not at low levels. If it's rain, it's bad.
Yeah. Well, Carl in Madison has something for us. Hi, Carl. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hello. I always enjoy this program. Thank you for having it.
Sure.
I called back probably a number of months, maybe a year ago, talking about some research from Jennifer Francis, I believe out of Rutgers, where the theory was that the Arctic is warming, and as it's losing its sea ice, it's warming faster because of the lack of reflectivity of that sea ice than regions further south, and that her perspective and some other scientists were that this was causing an increase in temperature there, a decrease below it, and so the jet stream was starting to lose its velocity and really meander around, causing a lot of these lobes of cold pushing south toward us, or lobes of warm air moving way up into the Alaska region where they're not usually seen. And I was just curious the professor's thoughts on the recent volatility in weather and whether that might be gaining traction as a theory.
Interesting.
If I could comment on that, I'm working with Jennifer and Steve Vavris was her co-author in that first paper from 2012 where they first proposed this notion that what's called Arctic amplification, the lower troposphere is warming faster in the high latitudes, the Arctic latitudes, than it is at any other latitude in the Northern Hemisphere. That's not conjecture. That's actually measurable fact. The consequence of that is what's conjecture right now. Is that changing the nature of waves in the middle and upper part of the troposphere? Embedded within those waves is the jet stream. And we've just developed a brand new metric for measuring the waviness of the flow in the middle troposphere. And surprisingly, this is such an important question. It has so many various tentacles to it. But surprisingly, there's no widely accepted metric for measuring the waviness in the flow. So we invented one that's pretty straightforward and very simple. And we're finding, actually, somewhat in contradiction to the original theory, we're finding that there's no observable trend in the waviness of the flow in the middle troposphere over the last 66 years. At least it's not statistically significant. There is, however, a strong relationship between when the waviness gets erratic and whether or not you have the sensible weather changes around the hemisphere. So that connection is pretty robust. And what we're hoping to do now with our new measure is look forward into the future with the output from climate models and see whether or not continued Arctic amplification is actually beginning or will, in fact, lead to increases in the waviness of the flow, in which case this suggestion would actually be verified, but the verification would be put off a little bit into future years, decades downstream. So we're looking at this exact problem. In fact, at home right now, I got a program running that's calculating specifically the waviness of the jet stream in a kind of a convoluted way. It's taken me days to run this program, but it's working. And that will be yet another perspective on this problem. So I'm going and talking about this problem in Phoenix, Arizona, the first week of January. So it's still a hot topic, unresolved, but we're trying to contribute to the solution.
Well, I look forward to reading the research, and there are huge ramifications for everything from crop production to where people live and the kinds of weather they need to sustain those livelihoods. So thanks for the research.
Thank you. And I'll just add one last thing about this to emphasize the nature of the scientific inquiry. The paper that we just finished on this in-house, the four of us collaborating on it, that's going to be submitted in about a week, but it won't be published for at least a year. And why is there a delay? It's not because people are lazy. It's a delay because every one of these ideas gets scrutinized by experts who want to disprove it. That's the nature of science inquiry. And so there are people, certainly it sounds like you're interested in this issue. There are people who are willing to suggest that science, especially when it comes to climate science, is simply given a pass. We don't get any scrutiny on it. I can tell you from personal experience that is not the case. These ideas will be beaten to death, right, and we'll have to prove every little iota of what we say in there. So that's the nature of science inquiry leading to our current conclusions about the climate.
Very interesting. Carl, thanks. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in as well at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions or your comments there and your photos. We love the weather photos that we get. And I'm telling you, if you're near your computer, you should go to our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and take a look at the weather photos that Cheryl has put up. A cloud formations. I have never in my life seen anything like these. And maybe you could describe them. Describe them for us, Steve.
Yeah, these are just great photos. It actually, so what it is, it's a cloud field, and the cloud extends from horizon to horizon, and these are altocumulus type clouds. So they're composed of liquid water droplets that are below freezing. So you can get water below freezing and still have it liquid and not ice form. And then embedded in this are what has been called hole punch clouds. So basically there's just holes in the clouds where there's nothing. They're nice and spherical.
Round circles.
Yeah, round circles. And typically what they are is planes will fly through these and cause the liquid water droplets to turn to ice crystals. And then the ice crystals rapidly grow at the expense of the liquid water clouds, and then they precipitate out. And you can see this in the third figure that she has down in there where and you have this... hole again in the cloud field, but in the center of that hole, you can see this dropping, this triangular shape.
Yeah,
and that's just the ice crystals,
like.
A funnel.
Yeah,
and those are the ice crystals just dropping out
like
of the cloud
teeth.
As they get really big. Yeah, right.
It's like a shock has bit the balloon.
Yeah, and that last picture in particular, I've never seen. In fact, I'm going to probably ask you if we can put it in the next version of our book. The other ones, you can kind of see it, but here you can actually see them falling out, which
right.
is
that's
just
very
incredible.
Dramatic. Yeah, you get a really good view of it.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and these are known in the literature, I think, as aircraft-produced ice particles, APICs.
Oh, right.
Ah!
And my best friend, one of my best friends, who now lives in Arizona, used to be at the University of Washington, was a guy who discovered that this happens. He'd been on aircraft research flights 300 or more times in his career, and he noticed that there's sometimes what were first anomalous ice crystals in what was a stratocumulus deck, supercooled water, as Steve said, and they're produced by propellants from aircraft engines.
Really?
And that's
really
how you see them. You see them a lot
really
in your
amazing.
Airports.
Well, I hope, as you're listening today, I hope you'll go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and take a look at those photos because they are unbelievable.
Yeah. And if you look on satellite images, you'll sometimes see these as holes again, punched, but
right.
you also see them as lines. So if the plane, punches right through it, then you get a circle. But if it slowly transverses the cloud deck, then you'll get a line that'll develop. It's
very
really
long,
amazing.
Elliptical shape. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Steve Ackerman and John Martin are guests today from the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, our weather guys. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk weather and climate with our weather guys. Just to let you know, coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen is joined by two independent filmmakers to discuss their film, Rich Hill. It's a documentary that follows three teenage boys as they struggle with broken families, isolation, and a lack of opportunity in their Missouri town. It was awarded the 2014 Sundance Film Festival Grand Jury Prize, and it airs on PBS tonight. So that's at 2 o'clock today, right here on the Ideas Network. But now we're talking about the biggest weather stories and events of 2014 with our weather guys. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And those really cool photos that we were just talking about from Cheryl. If you go on the left side of our page, go to posts to the page. I know some people were having trouble seeing those. Just go to post to the page, click on that, and those photos will pop up for sure. You'll be able to see them. Let's turn to Jeff in Milwaukee next. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, no problem. I'm amazed there's still a lot of debate and discussion whether there's global climate change or not, because part of science is observation. And if you simply look at the polar caps from satellite photos from the 70s and you compare them to today, the receding caps indicate something is going on at a global level, because it's not a couple of days you're going to have. When you have, you know, levels of water in Great Lakes dropping by feet, you have to ask what's going on. In other words, when there's not enough precipitation to, you know, return the water. And how much do the holes in the ozone layer play in this?
Yeah, you're right. That our science in particular is very observational, and there's a lot of evidence that climate is changing. In fact, we are doing a MOOC, an online class, starting in February, about changes in the Great Lakes region. And what we decided to do was not just talk about the weather, but look at the changes just in terms of observations and not even get into the idea of what climate models are predicting. And what you see, of course, is that the world, the Great Lakes area, is changing. And those changes are all very consistent with one another. So we see a warming trend. It's warmed up about 2 degrees Fahrenheit since about since the 1900s. We see less lake ice on the Great Lakes compared to about the 1960s. While there's a lot of natural variability, there's about 70% less ice coverage on the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
There's generally less snowfall, except in the snow belts. The snow belts tend to show increased snowfall, which at first you might think is kind of odd, but it's consistent, because with a warmer atmosphere, you end up with less lake ice, and the snow belts are generated as air moves over the open water, increases evaporation, and therefore increases the snowfall. And so it all holds together in terms of the changes that we're seeing and the physical consistency of those changes.
Yeah, I agree very much with Steve. I think until the last 5 maybe years, I think there's been a conflation between weather at a locality, and that's easily used by skeptics to suggest that there's nothing going on globally. But as Steve points out correctly, what's been happening in the research community recently, at least some of us have been thinking about this, who were maybe trained as experts in understanding weather systems, our attention's been turned to how do those weather systems change in a changing climate as a hypothesis. Let's just see if that's worth investigating. It turns out that some of the changes one might expect theoretically are actually the changes that the observations suggest. And so that adds a new layer of complexity to the way that we have understood this set of changes. And I think that's really interesting, because skeptics of any idea usually like to cherry pick. They like to find one thing that kind of they think stands out alone and is a useful place to stand and make a stand about how, a broader theory is not correct. The people who are anti-evolution do this all the time. And they find it difficult, though, when all kinds, all manner of evidence from far-flung places actually point in the direction opposite to their skepticism. And I think that's exactly what's happening now with the idea that the climate is changing and that human beings have had a role in making it change. And we probably have a role in, we definitely have a role in cleaning up the act.
Mm-hmm.
There you go, Jeff. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Let's go to Ed. I was going to say the next caller is Ed from Lodi, so let's go there. Hi, Ed.
Hi. My question is, my son went through your weather program there. He's a meteorologist in the National Park Service in the Fire Management Group, and he gave me a book to read here, Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything, and it ties in just what you were talking about. I wonder what you think about her research.
I am not aware of that book.
I'm aware of it. I haven't read it.
Yeah.
I haven't read it myself, so I don't know. What's the argument she makes, Ed?
Yeah.
Well, she's just what you were talking about, is that, you know, we have affected the climate, you know, with the carbon that we've, pumped into the atmosphere. And then she just goes through and talks about, addresses the skepticism that people have that, you know, we are the result of this. And then she gets into various theories of, you know, what we can do about it.
Yeah.
Like one, just finishing, is like pumping sulfur, you know, into the air, you know, to cut down on the rays and the heat. And then she goes through and talks about, well, look what happened with the volcanoes and, you know, the impact of those when they pump sulfur. So she really goes through and talks about, you know, the research and the meetings that they've had. I think one just down in South America where people came together and talked about this and addressed it. And it's a recent book. Boy, it's just really eye-opening.
Yeah, yeah. I do intend to get to that book in the coming year because I'm aware of it but haven't read it. I didn't realize that she brings up some of these issues of what's called geoengineering, which is, you know, trying to admitting there's a problem with the way the atmosphere is composed now and maybe putting off who's the cause of that and who's guilty, but then trying to re-engineer the atmosphere by some major industrial effort to maybe, as you point out, put more sulfur in the atmosphere, which we theorize. We're not certain about this. Is one of the really big unknowns in the climate system is whether or not that actually is the biggest thing that helps to promote an aerosol indirect effect, which might cool the planet. But boy, I don't want a clumsy, arrogant species like us going in there and trying to tinker with a system that's been working for 5 billion years as if we know exactly how the outcomes are going to come. I'd prefer to not do that. And I think maybe she makes that argument in the end, but I don't know.
Yeah.
So she does make that argument there. And then at the same time, she, you know, addresses the, you know, what we should be doing about it. And, well, even the tar sands in Alberta, places of that nature and what it's doing to the globe and and the water, you know, everything else, and how we're the toxicity that we're, inducing into the atmosphere, you know, the world.
Yeah.
Ed, by the way, if you don't mind, would you give us your son's name?
Yeah.
Yes, it's Steve Marion, M-A-R-I-E-N.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I know Steve.
Yeah.
I do know him. I met him through work with the Forest Service. How do you like that? I think he graduated before I came to the campus or. But just before, I've met him. He's a really good young man. Yeah, great scientist.
Yeah. He's out of Milwaukee and Minneapolis and has a 20-state area, so he works in the whole fire management area.
He's got a huge job.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the controlled burns and then also emergency situations.
Yeah. And, you know, this past weekend, I was looking at, you know, again, how things are changing in the Great Lakes region and thinking, okay, if the air temperature is warming, then what's happening to the ground temperature? And this is going to get to forestry in a minute.
Yeah.
And what they're finding was a study that looked at, by some faculty here at UW-Madison, that looked at the length of the time the ground is frozen in Wisconsin. And what they're finding is that length of frozen ground is decreasing, which impacts logging and forestry.
Yeah,
because in the wintertime with the frozen ground, it's easier to get in there. Hmm. And once the ground starts to thaw out, then it gets muddy and they can't get in there and do things as much.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. So it changes everything.
It does. Title of the book.
Right, yeah.
Well, it's also screwing up all the agriculture. I'm just looking at our plants out here. And the plants, you know, they think they're going dormant, and then it warms up, and then they go dormant and back and forth. And,
yeah, right.
You know, it just gets that all screwed up also.
Yeah.
And growing season's lengthening as well. So that actually changes agriculture as well.
Yeah.
And insect populations are going up in ones that we don't necessarily want, like the gypsy moth, which really is a negative impact on hardwood forests.
Yeah, we got to do something here to really control this, and everybody's got to pitch in to help
control this. That's right.
Yeah.
Ed, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And if you've got some weather photos, we'd definitely love to see those at the Larry Mueller Show as well. And again, if you go to posts, I've had quite a few people, I think, going on Facebook saying, I can't see those photos. But if you go to posts to page, that's the place to go. Click on those. You're going to see those really cool weather photos that Cheryl posted a little bit ago. I had a Facebook question from Tony, who says, no one believes me that while I was driving in downtown, driving down in Arizona, that out of the clear blue sky, a bolt of lightning flashed across the sky. Clear blue sky. Here comes a bolt of lightning. How is that possible?
I would guess that there's a thunderstorm in the area. And that it came out of the anvil and then comes down and hits the ground. It's what we call a bolt out of the blue.
Yeah.
And again, part of that is goes along with lightning safety. You know, that if you know that there's thunderstorms in the area, you're at risk at getting hit by one of them.
Yeah.
So that could have been 20 miles away or something?
Or more, yeah, or even more.
Even more?
Yeah. It's amazing. So there are new detectors out there on lightning that track the three-dimensional movement of lightning, not just if it hits the ground or not.
That's awesome.
Is amazing. I mean, I've seen bolts travel 50 miles.
Wow. Oh, man.
Yeah, it's just incredible.
I wonder if that's enhanced in a desert area. You know, if maybe you get a little bit of wind and you get some static because of the sand blowing around in the wind or something.
Oh, that could be. That could be.
Might increase it.
Yeah.
On the boundary.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I was very interesting.
We believe you, Tony, but stay away from Area 51.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that could be another explanation.
Oh, man. We had listener Darcy in Greendale's phone, but then had to hang up. I couldn't stick around. Wonder is how volcanic eruptions affect climate.
They tend to cool the climate for a while. The most recent one, I think, that had that discernible effect was Pinatubo, right?
91, 92.
Yeah. And it was cooler the next year by some fraction of a degree Celsius around that northern hemisphere because it was erupted in the northern hemisphere. So I think they tend to cool the climate.
They do. The key is the type of eruption that you get. So what you need and what Pinatubo had is you need to have sulfur in the cloud, and it needs to be explosive so that sulfur gets up into the stratosphere.
Yeah.
Once it gets in the stratosphere, that's a very stable region of the globe. And it can stay there and get converted to sulfuric acid droplets. And then that reflects, except it's up in the stratosphere.
Yeah.
So you don't want to fly in it. Right, yeah. And that reflects solar energy, and it's kind of related to geoengineering. That's one of the things they want to do. And then Pinatubo, I think, resulted in a 2-degree decrease in global.
Oh, was it that much?
Yeah, it was a pretty big train.
Yeah, I knew it was notable. Everybody noted
right,
it.
Yeah. And the big one, of course, was in 18.
Krakatoa. And baby Krakatoa is getting big. You know, there's a new island that came out of the ocean after the first one blew up.
Oh, really?
Baby Krakatoa is huge.
Yeah.
So now what was, give me the, I can't, people are going to say, what the hell, Christmas, Krakatoa, what the heck?
Mm. So that went off in 1816, I think it was.
Oh, 1888, August 24th,
1888.
Our anniversary.
Yeah, 18, okay.
That's when Vesuvius went off, too. It's kind of one of those dates.
So I'm thinking of the other one that went off in 1816 that led to the year without
Tambora.
A summer.
Tambora.
That's the one that went off.
Tambora.
Yeah. And that resulted, again, in a cooling of the planet, led to frost in New England in June, July, led to terrible weather in Switzerland, and led actually to a group of authors telling stories.
Mm.
Who can tell the scariest ghost story? Because the weather was crappy. Sorry for my language there.
Yeah.
And so they stayed indoors and they told ghost stories. And the winner was Frankenstein.
Mary Shelley wrote
Frankenstein. That led. Not only does it impact climate, it could also impact literature.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Well, there's lots of ways that...
Volcanoes do it.
In fact, isn't Edvard Grieg's famous scream, the color of the sky?
Oh, right.
Scream,
that's right.
That's Krakatoa.
Right, that's right.
That's awesome.
And actually, there was some new analysis, and I'm saying this is new because it came up earlier and then was discredited, but it's gaining ground again in the demise of the dinosaurs. It's been argued for a long time, and it's very credible that there was a meteor impact that led to the demise of the dinosaurs. But there was also a lot of volcanic activity in the subcontinent of India. And so that was also thought in the past, and again, that theory is now coming up. There's been new evidence to support that it might have been the combination of both the meteor and the volcanic fields. And it wasn't explosive volcanic activity, but just the release of gases that could have impacted the temperatures again around that time, 65 million years ago.
Wow. Oh, man.
So they have a big impact.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was thinking, when I was thinking about the weather and having an effect socially, is weather that knocks out power And then 9 months later, there's a big upturn in the number of births.
Yes, that's right, right, because of the blackouts. Right?
Blizzards do the same thing.
Right, you get locked at home.
Blizzards will do the same thing. Well, enough about that. Let's talk some more about weather here with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. If you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in. Have you witnessed any interesting weather phenomena? We'd love to hear about it and also to see your photos if you have them. Maybe you have some questions about our current weather or what we might have in store for us this winter. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Again, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and we can certainly love to hear from you about those. I want to go back to some of the big events from this past year. Tornadoes. Now, we had here in Wisconsin, we had a fairly, I think it was a fairly mild, quote-unquote mild year when it comes to tornadoes, was it not?
I think so. I think that's my recollection, too.
Yeah. And I think in general, across the U.S., there wasn't very many tornadoes.
Yeah, what I thought, too, yeah.
In 2012, that was the big thing to talk about, right?
By
the big tornado outbreaks in the southeast.
Yeah.
But
there was one terrible one that, was it Pilger, Nebraska, had two.
Oh, and yeah, from the same event, right? It was
a single supercell of thunderstorms.
Yeah, and I think at one point there were seven different funnels on the ground from that same thunderstorm, and then Pilger hit by two of the rather more impressive of those seven. So, that was pretty wild.
It essentially eliminated about 75% of the town.
Yeah.
Damaged. Wow. Beyond repair, about 75% of the town. So,
but if I remember right, not a huge death toll. Is that right?
No. And I don't think. Well, I don't know that there were any deaths.
Yeah, and it was. Yeah. How do you account for that? Forecast warning time. Now, here's a thing that has improved. It's in another category than it was 25 years ago, and that's pure advance in meteorological observation and prediction there.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
New radars are making even better to pick them up.
Amazing.
Well, let's turn, lots of callers online here, so let's go to Tom in Cedarburg. Tom, hi, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, I'm hoping I can get two quick questions.
Sure.
One is that I had heard that one volcano puts up more pollution in the air than mankind has ever produced, since the beginning. And the other question I have is that I'm into sunspot activity, and I know from 1650 to 1710 or 20 was the sun was very calm, and in that time period, there was temperature drop like 3 degrees, and there was a havoc as far as disease and crops and all that kind of stuff. And I've not heard any mention about sunspots.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I don't. That's a good question about the volcanoes and the amount of debris they can put out versus air pollution generated by human societies. And I'm things that are running through my mind is how much debris did Mount St. Helens produce? I'm sure somebody has a measurement of what that was. That didn't have a climate impact because it didn't make it into the stratosphere.
Yeah, right.
But it sure did add a lot of ash that went all the way to Wisconsin.
Yeah, we had it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. My instinct would be that maybe all of the volcanoes in the last, maybe in recorded history or something, might be close to what human beings have been able to put out in the industrial era in terms of gaseous pollution in the atmosphere that resides there. But I can't believe that a single volcano is able to do that. I don't care how powerful.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem possible to me that that's right.
Yeah, but I mean, I was thinking, thinking of sunspots as well in the the 91 war with the Gulf that we had. We were actually over there studying the pollution plumes from the burning fires, which is air pollution. Mm-hmm. And I remember coming home one of those days. In fact, that's where I think I met Art for the first time.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. coming home from that experiment, not coming home, going back to the hotel one time, I was just exhausted because you get really tired during these field programs because you're up early and you're staying up late, just looking out the window and looking at the sun. It was setting through this plume of smoke that was high up in the atmosphere. And I reached to the window to scratch it off because there were some spots on it.
Oh, yeah.
And there were sunspots.
Oh,
I could visually see them with the human eye. And I just made the experiment so much more worth it because it was kind of a depressing field program.
Although the result of that field program was there was nothing other than a regional effect.
That's right. It was a very important thing.
Enormous fire.
Right.
Yeah. So that was kind of a counterintuitive. Everybody expected it would
be there would be global impact, and there really wasn't.
So but I think the sunspots, you refer to the Maunder, the so-called Maunder minimum.
Right, that's right.
And I don't know very much about that, but I think there was also a period of very high volcanic activity around the globe in the same period. So those who have suggested that it's the lack of sunspots only that contributed to that notable cooling have been sort of harangued by those who say, wait a minute, don't forget the volcanoes that were sort of anomalously active at the same period of time. And they, as we've been talking about, provide a cooling mechanism generally to the atmosphere. So it may be a combination of both. Sunspots do actually, I think, have something to do with the amount of energy that's hit by that the atmosphere of Earth absorbs from the sun. But they didn't seem to act alone. They were acting in concert perhaps with something else at that period of time.
Interesting. All right.
Yeah.
Tom, thanks. Appreciate the call. Let's give Ron a chance to join in as well from La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, when you started discussing about the year without a summer, 1816, there's an interesting story concerning that in the Old Farmer's Almanac. And it was just a coincidence, but when the typesetter was setting up the movable type for the 1816 edition of the Old Farmer's Almanac, the typesetter made a mistake, and he put a prediction of snow for winter in the wrong month, and he just happened to put it in the month of June, which was probably around the time that volcano erupted and lowered the global temperatures. So that the result was, believe it or not, the very days that he made the typo in June, it snowed, I guess, in New Hampshire. And ever since then, the Old Farmer's Almanac has supposedly had this infallible reputation for predicting weather. If you can predict snow in June, which rarely ever happens except for probably the year 1816, then you must have really something going for you. But it was just a mere coincidence.
Ron, that is awesome, Ron. I've got to tell you, I have been waiting for this story for years. All right, so that means that for 200 years, this rag of a weather forecasting journalist has been able to rely on that goofball accident for its reputation. I love the Farmer's Almanac, but do not consult it for meteorological advice, as I've said many times on this show. And you've just shown everybody who's listening why.
And so we always talk about the fact that we don't know how the Farmer's Almanac makes it forecast.
Right.
Now we know. Typos.
And secondly, we didn't know how it made its reputation. This is more important, and now we know that. So that's a great story.
Thanks, Rod. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, our guests today from UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at the weather and climate today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, and certainly looking forward to hearing from you with your questions or comments. Have you witnessed an interesting weather phenomenon or have a question about the weather or climate? I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. Eric in Madison up next. Eric, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to say your earlier conversation about lightning brought back a memory of mine when I was working for the Forest Service in New Mexico, right in the same area as a very large array, the VLA, all the satellites, the radio telescopes. We were studying bats, and so we would put radio transmitters on them, and so then we would track them with our telemetry gear and hike up to high peaks and listen for the pings from the
telemetry, but that was also during the monsoon season that would come through New Mexico at that time, and I just remember it's a beautiful episode of or experience of seeing the clouds and the monsoons just start coming across the valley below me, and then I kind of realized that I'm standing on top of a peak with a
at least you realized it.
And then I was like, I should probably get down from
here.
Yeah.
That was a good thought.
Right?
Maybe a really good idea.
Yeah. It's not the best place to watch thunderstorms from.
It was such a beautiful thing to see. And again, I was reminded because of the lightning. Yeah, I put my antenna away and ran back down.
That's good thinking, Eric.
Oh, I remember being on Mount Lemmon in Tucson, and we're way up, and it's interesting watching the storm below us.
Right.
I thought, oh, wait a minute, let's get back in the car.
Yeah.
This is probably a good idea to be in the car.
Because there's nothing that says lightning has to go down.
No, that's right.
Lightning can go up.
I'm standing out there trying to get a photo of lightning in the air with my cell phone. I'm thinking, what am I doing? Oh, my goodness. Eric, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Larry in Dallas, Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, good afternoon or good morning, wherever you're at. This is going to be kind of off-the-wall question, but I heard him say 65 million years ago. Now, I've heard 45 to 55, now 60. I mean, that's a long, long time. How do you guys determine that the world or the universe is that old? I'll take my answer off the
air. Okay, so how do we know how old the Earth is?
So that reference was to when the dinosaurs were. We know that the Earth is 4.52 billion years old.
Yeah.
And plus or minus 50 million years.
Yeah.
and the way they do it is dating rocks, both on Earth as they come up through the crust. Radiocarbon dating is one process. They also do it with moon rocks and meteorites. And from that, they can figure out that the age of the Earth is. So what happens is as elements decay, they have an e-folding time, it's called, of their decay rate. And if you know what that is and you can count how much of a particular element there is in the rock, then you can figure out how old it is.
Yeah, how long it's been decaying. And then to figure out the universe, it sounds dumb, but this is true. It's just like when you hear a fire truck drive by your house. You hear the sound coming louder when it's on its way toward you, and then you hear it recede as it goes past you. The same thing happens with light waves. Those are sound waves. Same thing happens with light waves. And we've measured the expansion of the universe by knowing how fast the boundaries are moving away from us by this same kind of shift. And the estimate is fairly accurate, we think, but it's 13.5 or so billion years old, the current state of this universe.
Jeez.
So pretty unbelievable.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Ray in Rhinelander has something for us. Let's go there. Ray, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you again, Larry, for having these cool guys on. They kind of remind me of the click and clack of climate reality with all the joking in that. I really love it. It's really making my day. I have two things. First of all, they've been checking on, supposedly scientific, I've been hearing on solar flares and how they've gotten a little bit stronger these last 2 years, especially this year, and how they affect our weather. And also on global warming, I know we all talk about that a lot. We try to explain it, and obviously it's there. There's scientific proof. But, you know, like we live in Rhineland, Wisconsin, you know, whatever weather we have is getting more extreme or cold. Like this week, we're back in Siberia, literally. And then we go to the southwest United States where everything is drying up. Isn't that part of it that shows about the global warming, the extremes in each area? And I'll take it off the air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Ray.
Yeah, so the sun going to the solar flares does go through cycles. And a couple of years ago, we were in a really quiet period of the sun. And by quiet period, it means you don't have a lot of solar flares, you don't have a lot of sunspots. And since then, we've entered a more active period. I don't think it's an anomalously highly active period, although I will say this. I have signed up for the Space Weather Watch for flare activity because the great thing about increased flare activity is you increase your probability of seeing the northern lights. The impact on the climate or on weather really hasn't been demonstrated in terms of what the physical cause is. There seems to be a correlation, but nobody's been able to point why any correlation or what the causation of that would be, and that's a real problem.
It seems like it has effects on a lot of what we depend on for our everyday life, you know, infrastructure and communications. That's clear that there's real impacts on that. But I agree with Steve. Impacts on the weather are really hard to pin down. And then the other thing about extremes, I think this has become a high-profile bridge that some climate scientists have tried to throw out to not only society and generally, but other scientists, that we can actually now start to say that there are more extremes as a consequence of climate change. I'm skeptical of that, as many people are, I think, and I'm skeptical as a scientist. Not that that's not theoretically impossible. I think there's actually a reason to expect that's the case. I just think we haven't yet figured out how to pin it down. It's not, in my mind, a solved problem. And I think sometimes the press coverage of that aspect of climate change discusses it as if it's already well known. And I think that's a mistake. I think that's hyperbole. Yeah. And we're going to get there, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, extreme events means that they're rare.
Right.
And so getting statistically significant trends on rare things is pretty tough.
It's
even
difficult.
Though you could see that the data is, you know, maybe demonstrating that you're getting more flooding or more precipitation
right.
with an event.
That's right. And a lot of climate scientists need to learn more about weather systems. And I like my colleagues. I think they're very smart people, but they don't know about weather systems the way that people have been trained to think about weather systems do, and sometimes the statements they make are just not quite right.
Yeah.
And so making the connection is still not 100% in my mind.
Yeah. Somebody wondered, what really are sunspots and why would they have an impact on weather?
Whoa, the best question on why they would have an impact on weather is a great one. There's been no evidence that they do because we haven't been able to figure out what that physical connection is. Sunspots, my astronomy friends are probably going to yell at me like, what are you talking about the sun for? You're a weather guy, not an astronomer. But you might think of the sun as it also has weather. On the sun, and that weather is periodic. Sunspots are, I'd like to think of them as like convection that's going on in the sun. And so they're locally cooler areas that appear on the sun. But they're also, if you think of convection on, at least on Earth or in a boiling pot, you know, when something goes up, something's got to come down.
Yeah.
And so in association with the sunspots, which are generally cooler areas on the sun, there are also areas on the sun that accompany the sunspots that are hotter areas. And so even though as the sunspot activity goes up, the actual energy output of the sun, and particularly high energy particles, also goes up.
Mm. Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. Caller Orville wanted to know, wanted to thank you guys for your book. You have a book. Well, you've got a book.
We actually have an e-book of our.
We do the
weather column for the one of the regional papers,
for the Wisconsin State Journal. And other papers as well?
We're not syndicated yet. But we do have an e-book, and he may be the third.
Orville, yeah. How did you find that?
He may be the third owner of one of our copies.
I need you to track something for me down now.
All right. Well, he also asks. He wants to explain to his kids why the sky is blue.
Oh, Steve, you got to take.
Oh, that. Yeah. That's a really great question. And it actually is related to atmospheric physics and how light interacts with particles. And so when light interacts with particles, and now when I'm talking about light, I mean visible light.
Mm-hmm.
If the particles are big, then that energy as a function of color just goes anywhere. And it's how it goes is an independent of color. And that's why, in general, crushed ice looks white because the light that incident on them gets redirected or scattered in all different directions independent of color. As the particles get smaller, they begin to have preferences in how they interact with the different colors of light.
Right.
And so things the size of dust generally like to scatter red light more than any of the other colors. Mars has a lot of dust on it. It's a red planet.
Oh, sure.
It does it. As the particles get even smaller, like molecules, they prefer to scatter blue light more than any of the other colors. And so the atmospheric molecules that are floating around, the nitrogen, oxygens, and other gases in the atmosphere, prefer to scatter blue light. So as the sunlight hits the atmosphere, blue light tends to get scattered more than any of the other colors. The other colors also get scattered, but blue light is the most. Mm. And as a result, this is why sunsets also turn reds and orange. Because as the sun gets lower in the sky, it interacts with more molecules because the path length through the atmosphere is longer. And so by the time that sunlight gets to where we are, all the blue light is gone. It's been scattered out to space. And the only colors that reach us are reds and orange. And, of course, they get colors scattered, just not as intensely.
Not as much. And if you look at a really clear sunset, especially when there's no water vapor in the atmosphere, maybe a desert area is a really good one, our attention's always drawn to the reds and the orange on the horizon. But if you look up through the whole hemisphere, you can go through all the whole colors in the spectrum. You see purple right next to the black, and then you get a little bit of blue and green. It's awesome.
Yeah. I have not done that. Yeah. What a great idea. So,
and that's because the higher up, it's going through less molecules the number of molecules.
And you don't
decrease.
See as much because it's too high in the sky, but you do see it on the right conditions. That's awesome.
And if you want to demonstrate it to your daughter, there's some good ways to do that with milk and water. So if you take a glass of water and then just put a couple of drops of milk in it and stir it up and then shine light on it, you'll see that that water turns a bluish haze, particularly if you use skim milk.
Mm. Well, we usually have 2%.
2% will work good, too.
Well, I'm going to try that. Yeah, that's a great.
And then the other part about that with milk, then you could ask, well, why is milk white, right? And the other part with that is that the colors that get scattered are also a function of the concentration, and so there are fat particles within the milk, and there are a lot of them.
Yeah.
And if you look at the color of the sky in a really blue day, a really cloud-free day, which would mean blue, if you look straight up, less molecules, it'll be bluer. As you look to the horizon, it tends to get whiter because there are more molecules, and then the oranges and the reds tend to mix with the blues, and you get whites.
You know what? You never know what you're going to learn on this show.
No? You never know.
You never know. And they're boys and girls, Steve Ackerman and John Martin are going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, then we'll be back with Steve and John. Stay with us. There's never a shortage of things to talk about with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. They're going to be talking about what they've been experiencing or what we can experience weather-wise. Coming up ahead here in the 2015, Larry Mueller here. Great to have John. John's a professor. So, Steve, of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Guys, great to have you back. And well, there's always lots to talk about, isn't there, John?
Yeah, there's always something to talk about, the weather. People do it at the bus stop.
Yeah, they do it in elevators.
Yeah, they're everywhere. Right,
do you guys get asked that all the time? I mean, is that a constant thing?
You know, it's relatively constant. People know that I'm not as good a forecaster as John, so maybe they don't ask me as often.
I'm not a good forecaster, but they know about the weather. I got a funny story about that. Last spring, we were watching the Baylor-UW game at a bar. My wife convinced me to go out to a bar with a bunch of her softball friends. I didn't want to go because I like to watch sporting events for my for my teams by myself in a little you know, a little bit of a monkish state, because I might get a little bit upset here and there. So as soon as we sit down to watch the game, and we'd already made an arrangement, we're coming home at halftime, this guy I didn't know comes up to me and says, "Oh, you're one of the weather guys. I want to talk to you at halftime about this." And I told him, "Pal, I'm not here at halftime." So, I mean, this is not a story to suggest I'm always rude, but I did not want to wait. I wanted to watch that game at home.
Oh, man. Well, that
so it happens a lot.
That is a good story. Well, Randy in Sauk County has something about a story as well, so let's go to Randy. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, I had a grandfather that was really good at the weather, and soon on he taught, he said, the Farmer's Almanac was just very unreliable, and of course that was not popular then, but he was very good at it. He had a barometer and so on, but the story I had to resolve in my own mind was this thing about the almanac, because as you might imagine, people would breed their cows by the almanac and everything else at one time. Mm-hmm. So my grandfather was the outlier. Now, this is the story that actually did happen. I don't doubt that the man that called in was told that story, but the way I understand it is the publisher was running up against a deadline, and the author had not finished various parts of the manuscripts that were being reviewed by this author, and finally he had to have the gaps filled in. He sent an emissary to the author, and the author was sick with what, again, could be conjectured now, but we, whatever that disease was, he was quite delirious. And when he was going down through these gaps, you know, this emissary from the publisher simply said, look, we have to have these things done, or else we can't go to press this year. And when he was getting to these predictions, that one, finally he said, and the, whatever the quote is here, once again, there was only one witness to this quote. It was something like, oh, I don't care, just throw in snow. And, so it was a complete guess. It was just a complete result of, it was nothing so easily described as a misprint, because they were actually very careful to have these manuscripts corrected back and forth. It was literally the guy just in delirium throwing in a pumpkin.
So we're going to have to look into this more. But, yeah, but either case, it's either a typo or a stated delirious, by a delirious
right.
person.
Randy, I was nervous when I saw your call on the line there. I thought, uh-oh, Randy's going to disqualify my now stronger view that the almanac's crazy. They didn't. You mean to tell me that they didn't go back to their time-honored formula and recalculate? That's great. That's great.
Well, you have to be delirious if you. You know, that's worth.
That's still a good story.
Awesome story.
It's got a good ending.
Yeah. That's an awesome story. Randy, thank you. Thank you very much.
First down.
Oh boy. Let's turn to Terry in Waupaca for something different. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I'm calling because I wanted to comment to your guests that I'm a retired U.S. Geological Survey scientist, and I worked on volcanic gas emissions at Mount St. Helens and Kilauea Volcano in Hawaii, and really throughout most of the volcanic areas in the U.S. and also some foreign sites. And in my career, I reviewed the literature on how much carbon dioxide comes out of volcanoes and tried to make comparisons of that with anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions. And the last paper I published on that, in fact, it was my last paper as a scientist, working scientist, was in EOS, which is probably a publication you're familiar with. And it's in the June 14th issue in 2011. And it's simply entitled Volcanic versus Anthropogenic Carbon Dioxide. And what the studies show with all the data available at this time is that the production of carbon dioxide by human activities is at least 100 times and maybe more, very likely quite a bit more than 100 times that of what comes out of volcanic
systems. Yeah, so, thank you.
Thanks. I actually remember reading that article.
Is that right?
Yeah, because I think we were redoing another edition of our book, and this question was coming up. So one of the questions that came up earlier today was not just about carbon dioxide, but about the debris as well, the aerosol mass. Do you know about that?
I didn't study the dust aerosol mass, but I studied the sulfur dioxide emissions.
Yeah.
And that produces, it's mainly the sulfur dioxide emissions that give rise to the sulfate formation in the stratosphere, which actually causes the cooling. And those are, the emissions from volcanoes are comparable with human emissions in that regard. You're looking at something on the order of, at least 50 megatons per year on average.
Okay. And the agency to get them into the stratosphere. That's what might differ from
And you need to get them to the stratosphere, right. Yeah. If the eruptions aren't big enough to get into the stratosphere, they don't have too much of an effect. And by the way, Mount St. Helens did get into the stratosphere, but it was not a very sulfur-rich eruption. It produced about 1 to 2 megatons of sulfur dioxide only.
That's right.
Pinatubo was quite large. That produced about 50 megatons. And, of course, it had a long-term, not really a, many-year term cooling effect, but it did cool the atmosphere for on the order of 3 to 4 years. And it did it by, like you were saying, 1 to 2 degrees centigrade. Yeah.
Wow. That's great. That's a great number to have. Thanks so much for calling.
Terry, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate it. You can phone in anytime. Yeah. We'd love to hear from you.
With a correction.
and Eric in Watertown is next. Hi, Eric.
Good afternoon. I have kind of a unique question. I've been a weather spotter for the National Weather Service for about 20 years now. And about 2006, 2007 time frame, we had a tornado outbreak in the Fond du Lac, Dodge, Jefferson County areas. And I've always had a knack for being able to pick which thunderstorm was going to go tornadic. And pretty much all the thunderstorms in the area had disappeared, but then I noticed on the horizon that there was little dots of cumulus clouds, and each dot was getting successively bigger, and I could tell that there was going to be at least a thunderstorm out of one of those clouds because they were growing very rapidly. And I picked which one I wanted to follow, and the National Weather Service issued a tornado warning because apparently there was rotation in the one I was following. Well, I got close enough to it to where I was able to see the wall cloud, and I was able to see it rotating, and just as I was about to phone it in, the entire wall cloud came down and came in contact with the ground. And I was not sure how to report that. Do I report it as a tornado, or do I just report it as a rotating wall cloud?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know what the word would be for that, except you've got the rotating mesocyclone that's now shrouded by like a rain curtain or a cloud curtain. That's rather
right.
Unusual. So that's not probably the tornado, but probably you pierce that curtain and you're going to see some funnels on the ground. I don't know what you'd call that. I suppose you'd still call it the wall cloud.
I'd call it dangerous. Reported that way. But
yeah, man. If you had used that description of the wall cloud surrounds the mesocyclone and it's hitting the ground, people would know what you mean, but they'd also say instantly, like you did, wow, that's really rare. I've never heard of that before. So
right.
I don't know. I would guess that's the right way to report that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And Drew in Lake Mills, hi.
Yes, hi. good morning. I've got a, I can answer both your things, Larry, you asked for a question and a story. So, you know, with modern technology, I'm a physicist, and what really drives me crazy is not being able to explain something. And hearing you two gentlemen explain a lot of the recent weather events is absolutely great. But I was wondering, I come from Massachusetts, and I was wondering if you can explain the events of the Great Blizzard of 1978.
Yeah, where are you from, Drew?
Outside of Wista.
Oh, yeah, I'm from Peabody originally. So,
oh, sure.
For better or worse, I wouldn't be sitting here right now.
I think Wista is worse.
Yeah, you guys usually got more snow than us. For better or worse, I wouldn't be sitting here right now if this storm we're talking about had not occurred. Because I was, this was eighth grade for me. I got a whole bunch of different interests. I don't know which one I'm going to pursue. I had a morning paper route. I thought I was Neil Armstrong. And when we got this snowstorm, that was unbelievable. We had 2 days where the Boston Globe and the Herald were not deliverable. They didn't even get delivered
really?
In my house. It was the only furlough I had in 8 years in that job.
Unbelievable.
And it was because of this storm. And
yeah.
I see this storm was rare, as you know, as well as I do, but not unprecedented. In fact, I don't know how long you've moved from Worcester, but in April of 1997, April 1st, 97, there was a massive blizzard that pretty much hit just southern New England. And all manner of snowfall records for the month of April were broken in 1 day. So these storms are unusual, but they are not really unprecedented. And so it's not really an anomalous or climate anomaly. It's just a weird circumstance. And you might remember, too, this is great talking to you, Drew. You might remember, too, that in late January 1978, there was a massive storm that, for us on the coast anyway, it was all rain. I don't know what happened in Worcester. I suppose it was probably all rain there, too.
Freezing rain.
Yeah, freezing rain for you guys. That was known as the Cleveland Superbomb. They had a massive snowstorm. It was one of the most intensely developing sea level pressure minima over the continent ever, and only recently displaced. Mm. And that was January 1978. And so it was just 10 days before the blizzard of 78. So there was a very active stormy period in that early part of the winter, 1978. But I have to say, despite my thrill that I experienced that, it's not really that anomalous. It's rare, but not that anomalous.
Okay.
So is it picking up moisture from the ocean?
Yeah.
You know,
kind of
like lake effect?
Yeah, that's the right kind of storm. The thing develops right along the coast off of Cape Hatteras and then goes right towards Cape Cod, right. And that water is about as warm as any water in the Northern Hemisphere.
So
and it just inundates you with either rain if it's a fall storm or snow, in this case, when it's a blizzard. And it was timed, as you remember, Drew, it was timed perfectly with the highest astronomical tides. And that was the other thing.
Yeah, that's bad.
You get flow coming in off the, because the storm is right to your south, and so you get easterly flow off the water, and the tides are high, and there was tremendous coastal flooding. So it was not just heavy snow, but coastal flooding.
Wow.
It was the only day that I remember my father not actually going to work. He worked at Wyman Gordon's in central Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah.
We went and we walked in the woods, and I mean, the tops of trees, I mean, everything was frozen in snow and ice, and it was like a different planet.
It was unreal, yeah. And Governor Dukakis declared a state of emergency, and that gave him a national profile, which 10 years later he ran for president.
Ran for president, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You guys talking together is in... You guys talking together is increasing your Bostonian accent. I don't know if you can.
Well, it's cool.
Drew, of beers.
Yeah. Drew knows as well as I do we're the only people in the U.S. who speak English.
Thanks, Drew.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. That's wonderful. You can call in, too. We have open lines. Get you on really quick at 1-800-642-1234. On our Facebook page, we have something from listener Mike. Says, on my way to work, and there's a photo along with it. On my way to work this morning, just north of Chippewa Falls, where I often see jet contrails, I saw some really unusual ones. All corkscrews, close to a dozen of them. Is this just pilots having fun or strange winds aloft? I wanted to see what the weather guys think.
Yeah.
And there's the picture now. It's... So that's hard to see.
Yeah, so if you go to the webpage and bring this up, again, contrails are linear-type cloud features that come out due to the jet exhaust mixing with cold, humid air in the upper atmospheres where they're flying. And a lot of times they're straight. In this case, they're not. I'm pretty darn sure that's not the pilot.
Yeah, right.
If it is, I wouldn't be flying that airline, that's for sure. But what it is, as he suggested, is wind shear. So the wind can actually move those around. So if it's moving more in one direction, then it's going to tilt it that way. And in fact, I've seen dotted contrails.
Oh, yeah.
So that,
like Morse code?
So like Morse code, yeah. So the air is sinking and going up and down in a regular manner. And where the air is going up, then the cloud stays around, and then where the air sinks, it warms, and it causes the contrail to go away. And it looks like a dotted line across
the
sky.
Cool. I've not seen that. But, these are neat because you're just like you said, you leave this trail of cloud, but then it's subject to whatever the winds are at that level, and then you get blown around.
Yeah.
Some good questions. I wanted to make sure I get them on because we got these emails quite a while back. Jim in the town of Middleton wondered, is the climate in the South Polar region changing in the same fashion and about the same rate as the North Polar region?
That's a very good question, and I can tell from the analysis that I've been doing about a question like that, particularly emphasizing the Northern Hemisphere because I trust the data a little bit more. There are some questions about how far back you can go reliably with data in the Southern Hemisphere. Simply not as many people live there. But the trends seem to be identical. And in terms of the area of the cold pool, which is smaller over the Southern Hemisphere's pole than it is over ours. But they do seem to be decreasing at the same rate at a variety of threshold temperatures. So from my perspective, I would say, yes, I think that the trends are roughly the same.
So the size of the pool is smaller? Is it colder, though, or deeper?
The coldest area is bigger over the Southern Hemisphere than it is over the Northern Hemisphere. But the skirt, the -5 degree air at a mile above the ground, is smaller. Because it hugs the coast of Antarctica.
And Antarctica is up at, it's higher than Denver,
feet,
so it's really, really cold.
So you have cold air that rings the continent, but it's not really excessively southern like it is here in the Northern Hemisphere.
Because there's no land. It's all open water.
That's right, no land. Right. So it's modified immediately.
Interesting.
Well, we have Barbara in Avoca wondered about the Lake Superior ice caves. Does anybody know if they're on track for us being able to see or visit, I should say, those ice caves?
I doubt it.
Last year's circumstance of prolonged cold was the thing that did it last year.
Yeah, you just needed those really cold temperatures to be able to walk out there. So I think they're probably still available, but I think you have to get there by boating, and it's probably really dangerous because of the ice flows.
Yeah,
so
the
unique thing about last year was you could actually walk out there.
Yeah,
And I'm wondering, now this is sort of centric to the Madison area, but... a lot of people know Lake Mendota and Lake Monona, and they're wide open today.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering about the freeze times on. I know Mendota's been freezing later.
I think the average ice on day for Mendota is the 19th, so we're already more than a week behind that. And I don't see us seeing that lake freeze for the foreseeable future. I just don't see it. Tonight and tomorrow will be really cold. It'll be the coldest point in this cold air outbreak, but this is fairly modest as they go, and then it warms up a little bit right away. So I don't know.
Yeah, and I think the Mendota freeze date is the 24th.
Oh, is that
on
right?
Average, yeah.
Okay,
so we're beyond that as well.
Yeah.
So, and there's been a trend for that. I mean, the 10 most open days are all in the last couple of last couple of decades.
That's right.
Kind of one of the interesting things for those in the Madison area, if you haven't seen the few hundred swans that are on Lake Monona right now, it's pretty cool.
Oh.
And on Lake Mendota, there are loons.
Was that right?
Yeah, there's a whole flock of them. And
wow.
So we live down the north end of that, and it's open water down there. And there's a whole flock of them. I mean, there's like 10 of them. I've never seen.
Well, there's a few hundred tundra swans, and then some Canada geese have joined them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite the little symphony sometimes in the morning.
Oh, I bet.
It's really
nice alarm
cool
clock.
To hear them all calling at the same time. Well, Chad in Decorah, Iowa has been waiting, so let's go there. Hi, Chad. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Hey, I got a question. We're talking about weather extremes, tornadoes, everything, but it seems like there's more flooding, perhaps, than there ever was. And I was wondering if there's ever been any studies or much said about, like, tile lines, you know, in farmers' fields, how they tile out all the fields so the water drains out of them faster. Mm. And couple that with, like, the no-till farming and some of the ditches now, they're just cleared. Instead of being real brushy, all the when it rains or rains heavy, it seems like all the water just flows through and is gone. So we got maybe more flooding events than we ever did? Or is that just kind of a something I'm dreaming of?
Okay.
No, I mean, it's a good question. I'm not sure with particular, because flooding is caused by a lot of different things. And as you're touching on here with regard to agriculture, particularly land use, whether you have more urban areas, whether the ground is frozen, how that water moves across the landscape. I was just looking at a study last week that was looking at flooding, and I think this was in the National Climate Assessment of 2014, that they were talking about increased flooding in the Midwest region in particular, and the Northeast, in comparison to other parts of the of the U.S., although I don't think they really talked about the reasons of why it was
why
getting more increased
more?
Fresh. And if they did, I don't remember. I'd have to go back and look at that
and
report.
And for some reason, too, as you asked your question, I'm beginning to imagine myself, what does it actually mean to have a flood? And I don't mean that except in the sense that locally, somebody's town square may be flooded, and that counts as a flood for people who live there, and that yet there might be a definition that's broader that in which that event doesn't qualify as a flood.
Mm.
And so, you know, the local things you're talking about, the way that water is forced to run off of fields that might be adjacent to a town could very well have an effect on the local definition of a flood, whereas I wonder how much of an effect it has on the on a broader, maybe statewide or countywide definition of a flood. And I don't even know if those definitions vary. But they might.
I'll bet they vary in terms of who's, like FEMA probably would call a local area not a flood.
Yeah, but that's a really good question. Yeah. I don't know the answer. Now, how does agriculture feed back into potential flooding events is another interesting question. If you grow a lot of corn, corn doesn't retain water very well. It's really bad at managing it. You might be enhancing the dew point temperature in the area around you when there's massive agriculture going on in a way that wasn't the case with a natural vegetation, and that leads to more maybe you have a greater incidence of thunderstorms in the summertime around that area. That leads to direct flooding. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. And, you know, there may be something, there's certainly, you know, when you're signifying something as a disaster area for flood, there's something that goes into play there.
Yeah, it has to be a threshold.
There has to be some sort of threshold.
Yeah.
So, and there also has to be a threshold to the program.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Oh, darn.
That's too bad.
And we've reached the...
I thought it was like till tomorrow.
Much of the state size and...
Yeah, that's right.
and just in 10 seconds colder, or what's the winter?
I would say it's equal probability of being colder, normal, or warmer.
I'll even go a little further than that. I'll say I don't think the equal probability of being colder is on track. There's no snow on the ground.
Ah.
And that's going to be a factor. That is going to be a factor in at least gestating cold air and maintaining it over us. Like this cold spell is very momentary because there's no snow on the ground. I think overall we're a little bit less than colder than normal.
And with that, we conclude. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.